Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, October 27th, 2020. I want you to brace yourselves, because as Congress has adjourned, at least until the lame duck session after the election, no action has been taken to stem the rising wave of evictions, foreclosures, and bankruptcies. A lot of people are going to get really badly hurt in the next few months. And our government is more interested in the political posturing to advance electoral interests. That applies to both parties. And the Republicans deserve special criticism for prioritizing packing the court with right-wing Amy Coney Barrett rather than attending to the needs of the American people. Now it appears that at least in the Senate and possibly in the House, the political fortunes of the Republicans are going to decline sharply, partly in response to this inaction. But in two separate reports today, we learn that renters, as many as 40 million, could be facing eviction in the near future. And some people are already being evicted despite the executive order that was issued by the CDC and embraced by Trump at the end of August, again, due to inaction by the Congress. While Trump said, this fixes it, nobody's going to be evicted at least until the end of January or February of 2021. That order was so badly written that judges in various jurisdictions have interpreted it differently. And the bottom line is that people are being evicted already. So the Washington Post focuses on a woman, a single mom in Lexington, Kentucky. Her baby was born in April. And she is facing eviction that could come any day now. And she actually meets the terms of the executive order. And that is that she doesn't have any money and that she will likely become homeless if she is evicted. So her landlord gave her a document. It's 522 words long, and she tried to navigate it. Here are the terms. I am unable to pay my full rent or make full housing payment due to substantial loss of household income. I have used best efforts to obtain all available government assistance for rent. If evicted, I would likely become homeless. But then she went to court. And I won't drag you through all of the ugly details. But the judge sided with her landlord. And the eviction has been stayed because they found a local law that protects her until the end of December. But the Post details many other cases where people who thought they had protection, at least based on the CDC document, have found out that there are loopholes that are being exploited by landlord and landlord groups. A woman in Queens said she was having trouble with the criteria. She said, you have to prove financial hardship, but how do I prove that I had a job lined up and it went away? And so there are many of these individual cases with particular circumstances that don't protect people. And, again, the courts in different states, different jurisdictions, view it differently. In Maryland, the courts have been instructed to still determine the merits of an eviction and then put a hold on actually permitting it. But across the border in Virginia, its state Supreme Court has not issued guidance, meaning that each jurisdiction is free to enact the order however it wishes. And one of the big loopholes is that you can be evicted for reasons other than not paying the rent. This allows grudge situations and paybacks to occur. One woman they cite had gotten into a beef with her landlord because, water was flowing out of the dishwasher and coming out of the ceiling. And when she complained, they decided not to renew her lease. Now, that forms the basis for eviction if you don't move out in time. But it is not technically an eviction move. And those are the games that are being played, and lives are on the line. And people will be forced out of their homes during the winter. And I fear a stunning rise in homelessness on the streets of many communities that aren't seeing it today. Or, here in my community, we have homeless people. But they're far more visible in San Francisco, where they've camped out in tents on the sidewalks, and where the pathologies of very difficult homeless cases play out on the streets every day. Now, couple this with the renewed risk of bankruptcy for Americans who have gone into debt, hoping that federal relief was coming, hoping that more unemployment checks were going to flow before the end of this year. And it's fascinating because the Washington Post frames this in a description of Joe Biden's role in the so-called reform of the bankruptcy laws about 15 years ago. The article opens thusly: 15 years ago, Senate Republicans thanked Joe Biden for helping them pass a new bankruptcy law over the objections of consumer advocates and liberal Democrats like one Elizabeth Warren. And now the former vice president has changed his position on that 2005 law, saying he supports many of the protections that he rejected back in the day. And as president, he says he'll push for letting people who enter bankruptcy discharge their student debts, protect the equity they've built in cars and homes. He embraced a plan put forth by Senator Warren that would also make more people eligible to file for bankruptcy and allow them to file without paying exorbitant legal fees. And those are the features, if you will, of the Biden-backed 2005 bankruptcy bill. And that was, he supported it because he's a senator from Delaware. Delaware is the scene of one of the biggest credit card operations, MBNA, which is now part of the Bank of America empire. And so he delivered for his big donors in Delaware. And at the time, this article quotes Biden as fighting back against people like Warren. He said at a 2001 Senate hearing, "An awful lot of people are discharging debt who shouldn't. I am so sick of this self-righteous sheen put on anybody who wants to tighten up bankruptcy being called an anti-debtor." And Warren, then a professor at Harvard, testified against the bill in 2005. "It treats every family. It assumes they're all in bankruptcy for the same reason, that they have overspent. This means that a family driven into bankruptcy by the increased costs of caring for an elderly parent with Alzheimer's is treated the same as someone who maxed out his credit cards at a casino." So, these are important issues. And I can already hear some of my partisan Democratic listeners saying, "Peter, come on. 7 days before the election, do you have to slam Joe Biden?" Well, I don't choose the news. I didn't write that article for the Washington Post. But I'm not going to bury it because it is inconvenient to Joe Biden, to his candidacy, or to Democrats who want to plug their ears right now and just say, "Well, we know Joe." Now, I want to recommend two pieces today that address the clampdown on publication and broadcast of the information about Hunter Biden that has surfaced in the past 2 weeks. And as I've said, I opened up yesterday talking about the gatekeepers who have decided that the information about Hunter Biden doesn't have sufficient evidence to be reported, when it's clear that they're not operating as journalists, they're operating as protectionists. And Matt Taibbi has a piece that's at his Substack site today. He opens with, how do you call something Russian disinformation when you don't have any evidence that it is? And he acknowledges, we don't know a whole lot about the New York Post story about Hunter Biden and how it got into print. There's some reasons to think the material is genuine, but in terms of sourcing, anything is possible. This material could have been hacked by any number of actors and shopped for millions, and all sorts of insidious characters, including notorious Russian partisans like Andrei Derkach, could have been behind it. None of these details is known, however, which hasn't stopped media companies from saying otherwise. So he offers a quick list of the creative methods seen lately of saying, we don't know, but we know. Number one, our spooks say it looks like the work of their spooks. A group of 50 former senior intelligence officials wrote a letter as soon as the Post report came out. Their most quoted line was that the Post story had all the classic hallmarks of a Russian information operation. Note they said information operation, not disinformation operation. Because, he says, even people with records of lying to Congress, like James Clapper and John Brennan, have been more careful with language than members of the news media. Taibbi continues, emphasizing that they didn't know if the emails are genuine. These former heads of agencies like the CIA added, quote, our experience makes us deeply suspicious that the Russian government played a significant role in this case. Politico, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, the Daily Beast, and many other outlets ran the spook testimonial. Number two, it was prophesied. And Taibbi says the Washington Post needed four reporters to tell us that four former officials familiar with the matter spoke of a long-ago report that would be the source of the New York Post emails. Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani had been interacting with people tied to Russian intelligence in Ukraine. As such, any information he brought back from there should be considered contaminated by Russia. And Taibbi comments, therefore, by the transitive property of whatever, the New York Post story, should be dismissed as part of an influence operation. Number three, authorities are investigating if it might be Russian disinformation. And this is a quote from a USA Today report. The FBI is probing a possible disinformation campaign. And the FBI, notes Taibbi, after the director of national intelligence went public and said, flatly asserted that Hunter Biden's laptop is not part of a Russian disinformation campaign, the FBI carefully said they have nothing to add at this time. And Taibbi continues, another neat trick was to discuss the Post story and in the same sentence refer to a present tense description of an apparently confirmed operation to discredit Joe Biden. CNN, quote, the FBI is investigating whether the recently published emails that purport to detail the business dealings of Joe Biden's son in Ukraine and China are connected to an ongoing Russian disinformation effort targeting the former vice president's campaign. And Taibbi says, thus, the essence of these new headlines comes down to intelligence officials are checking to see if the news story can be connected to prior claims of intelligence officials. Then he cites an op-ed published in the Washington Post by a guy named Thomas Ridd, a professor at Johns Hopkins, who said, we must treat the Hunter Biden leaks as if they were a foreign intelligence operation, even if they probably aren't. Now, this is so disingenuous. And again, I am not promoting the partisan action here so close to the election, where operatives like Rudy Giuliani drop this into the national conversation, such as it is. My critique is of the media for protecting us from information, not reporting, analyzing, and proving or disproving such information. So Taibbi goes on. I think he does a great job here. And I encourage you to read the entire piece. I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. He slams Adam Schiff appropriately for the repeated lies that he told about Russiagate and how what he now says about this new whatever it is has to be treated skeptically as well. So I think that that is one angle to look at. Now, the other is from Ross Douthat, who, for my money, is a fairly conservative columnist over at the New York Times. And he even invokes Matt Taibbi in his column while referring to him dismissively as a gadfly press critic. But Douthat, I think, has a respectable position here. He riffs on the Ben Smith column in his own paper that I led our podcast with yesterday about the gatekeepers of the corporate media being back on top. But Douthat, I think, does a good job of thinking critically, of trying to figure out if the origins of these stories matter, if the material on the alleged laptop of Hunter Biden is real and credible. And he said, it's hard to come up with any reasonable rule that would justify the suppression of the New York Post story that couldn't just as easily be applied to all the pieces of conspiratorial Trump-Russia reportage. Oh, that didn't pan out. I had to turn the page here. Now, this is stunning. This is self-criticism in the pages of the Gray Lady that has yet to occur in an official way. He says that capriciousness is a bad sign for the project of harnessing social media giants to filter out disinformation. It suggests that any filter would inevitably feel partisan, partial, and obviously reverse engineered. And his second point here, he says, again, stealing from Ben Smith's piece, the power of media gatekeepers to shape political coverage is still significant, and just because some charge or scoop circulates in the right-wing ecosystem doesn't mean that it has any impact beyond the realm of people who are already voting for Donald Trump. Well, this is an implicit embrace of stovepipe media, that the New York Times is above the ruminations of the extreme partisan right-wing media and can pick and choose which stories it wants to deal with. And the third conclusion of Ross Douthat here, he said the Hunter Biden controversy provides a clarifying case study. On the one hand, the new information is not the Biden-slaying blockbuster suggested by the New York Post, but neither does it fit the description offered by NPR's managing editor for News last week, explaining why they were only covering it as a media story. Quote, we don't want to waste our time on stories that are not really stories, and we don't want to waste the listeners' and readers' time on stories that are just pure distractions. Well, Douthat goes on. In fact, it's not a distraction to have a new insight into a potential First Son's business dealings, especially given that the saga of the younger Biden is a prime example of how in a milder-than-Trump form of corruption, how a milder-than-Trump form of corruption pervaded the American elite long before Trump came along, with important people and their families constantly finding ways to get rich in the shadow of the Pax Americana without ever taking anything so crass as a bribe. Now, one more quote from Ross Douthat here. More specifically, the Bobulinski story and the email evidence both suggest that Joe Biden took at least enough interest in his son's dealings to have a meeting during the Trump presidency with Hunter's business partners. This isn't proof that he partnered with Hunter or profited in any way, but it seems like evidence that he wasn't particularly worried about keeping his son's sketchy salesmanship at arm's length. That seems like information worth knowing. Not a scandal on a par with some of Trump's, not a front-page, bold-type, screaming headline, but something that belongs in the pages of a newspaper because it's interesting news. And I would compare this, the posture of Joe Biden that is depicted in these materials as similar to the tone-deaf nature of Hillary Clinton, accepting hundreds of thousands of dollars for speeches before she officially announced for president in 2016. Well, this is news I'm happy to report. Bill Barr has been served a comeuppance in trying to insert the Justice Department as a personal lawyer for Trump to attempt to kill the defamation suit that has been brought by E. Jean Carroll. She's the woman who accused Trump of raping her. When he denied it, said she's not my type, and just said it never happened, I never met her, even though there's a photograph of the two together. She sued for defamation, and the case was percolating along in state court in New York. But then Bill Barr, on the order of his buddy, the president, tried to turn this into a federal case, saying that Trump had responded to her as part of his official duties, and therefore he is essentially exempt from any prosecution because he's president and because there were official statements. But the judge in the case, Lewis Kaplan in Manhattan, said Trump's comments concerned an alleged sexual assault that took place several decades before he took office. The allegations have no relationship to the official business of the United States. And he ordered the case back to state court and dismissed this effort by the Bill Barr Justice Department to do dirty deeds, dirt cheap, for his dear president. And I think Bill Barr should be disbarred for this and many other antics that he has undertaken since he returned to the Attorney General's job. Well, the Supreme Court did it again yesterday. They intervened in the rules of a state election related to the presidential race, and they took up a case from Wisconsin. And essentially, they gave an order that the extension of the deadline for ballots to be received, not submitted, but received, was denied. And according to the count in Wisconsin, 1.7 million voters requested absentee ballots. 1.3 million have already returned them. There are 366,000 ballots still out there. And so Democrats are pulling out all the stops to reach voters, those 366,000 who are at least the Democrats among them, to try to ensure that they return their ballot either to a drop box delivered to the polls on Election Day or to an election office. And they are encouraging people not to trust the U.S. mail at this point. Louis DeJoy and the Postal Service committed postal fraud. They took out a full-page ad in Sunday's New York Times promising that all the ballots will be delivered on time. You have their word for it, as good as that could be. 4 years ago this week, I was in my hometown of Cincinnati to attend my mom's funeral, and I stayed for a couple of days and I observed the early voting that had been restricted to one precinct per county. And in Hamilton County, where Cincinnati is located, there were thousands of people lined up on a Sunday afternoon. The line extended out the building, around the block, down the street, under the freeway, for at least a mile. And the wait time for somebody who showed up at 4 o'clock was at least 3.5 hours. And they're using the same playbook in Ohio, where the current Republican Secretary of State decreed back in August that despite the expanded use of mail-in ballots this year, that each county could only have one drop box. And of course, you know, Cuyahoga County has nearly 1 million people, that's Cleveland, or a rural county like Noble County has only 8,000 people. And so, a lawsuit ensued because the federal recommendation is that there should be a drop box for every 15 or 20,000 voters. So the Trump campaign and Republican Party committees took the side of Frank LaRose. They lost in a trial court, a district court. Then Republicans took their case to a three-judge appeals court, which shut down the effort in a 2-to-1 ruling, and one of those votes is a Trump appointee. Republican efforts to make voting more difficult are all mathematically calculated to shave off a disproportionate percentage of metropolitan, urban-dwelling, minority, and poor voters, that is, voters most likely to vote Democratic. That's a quote from Subodh Chandra, an attorney who represented the advocacy groups on the losing side of the lawsuit. Nearly 40 states in the District of Columbia are allowing voters to use drop boxes to return mail ballots. It's Ohio and Texas who have restricted counties from offering more than one drop-off site. And in Ohio, the bipartisan election board of Cuyahoga County, they tried to modify the state dictate. They voted unanimously to establish drop boxes at 6 public libraries. But the Secretary of State promptly informed the county it couldn't establish the extra drop boxes because of the pending litigation. And it's just so clear that these are ways of preventing people from voting or preventing their votes from being counted. And that's why, friends, here we are 7 days out, and I look at the polls. Florida, Biden is up by 2. Georgia, Biden is up by 1. The bright spot is Michigan, where Biden is showing a 10-point lead. In Pennsylvania, it's plus 6 for Biden. But another one shows Trump up 2. And a third poll shows Biden up by 8. In Wisconsin, Biden is in 2 polls showing a 9-point lead over Trump. But when you consider what I just told you about Wisconsin, what I just told you about Ohio, these numbers are too tight. It is close enough for Trump and his minions to steal it, or to jam it up and create enough doubt that he uses his new advantage on the Supreme Court to muscle some legal process that orders voting to be stopped. Vote counting to be stopped. And that could occur anywhere between here and about the 10th of December. And I have friends who believe that Biden is going to walk away with this thing on election night, that early returns from Florida and Pennsylvania and maybe North Carolina will show that Trump doesn't have a chance. But because of the disparities where so many Democrats are voting by mail, so many of those ballots will be rejected. Others will be backed up in a counting queue that will take a week to 10 days to deal with. And so I am not confident at this point that Trump will be declared the loser in the end. I wish I had some happy talk for you, friends, but I don't. That woman from Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer, wrote an op-ed published today in The Atlantic. I've got a link to it for you in the show file for this podcast. She lays the blame for the attempted kidnapping plot against her firmly at the feet of the tweeter-in-chief, accusing him of sowing division and putting leaders, especially women leaders, at risk. Whitmer says she's not surprised by the scheme of the Wolverine militia. She vowed not to stand back and let the president or anyone else put my colleagues and fellow Americans in danger without holding him accountable. Quote, every time the president ramps up this violent rhetoric, every time he fires up Twitter to launch another broadside against me, my family and I see a surge of vicious attacks sent our way. This is no coincidence, and the president knows it. He is sowing division and putting leaders, especially women leaders, at risk, and all because he thinks it will help his reelection. Well, I haven't still have not watched the 60 Minutes interview from Sunday. We did get our electricity back in the evening last night. It was between 7 and 8 o'clock. And I am pleased about that. You know, it's not until you can't pay your bill or your utility cuts off your power that one is reminded of how much we rely on the convenience of predictable electrical service. At any rate, in the 60 Minutes interview, Trump denied that he had attacked Governor Whitmer, even though he's repeatedly insulted her, made derisive comments about her leadership, and at the it was in Muskegon, Michigan last weekend when he continued to attack her. He denied it. He said, "I haven't gone after her." Really, Don? What would it take to meet the criteria in your particular definition of going after someone? So Democrats are optimistic that they will not only retain the control of the House of Representatives, the current margin is 232 to 197, but that they may pick up as many as 20 seats in what could be a very big blue wave when all the votes are finally counted. Well, Twitter so far has not suspended or even tagged an erroneous or intentionally deceptive tweet by Trump earlier today. And I first heard about this in my 10-minute little interlude with Rush Limbaugh on the way to the secret studio. He opened up the second hour of his show with a very confusing rant. He first attacked Google for promoting information that you can change your vote. And the New York Post wrote a piece about this. Co-owned Foxy Friends picked up the story. Trump watched Foxy Friends. He tweeted about it. Limbaugh saw the tweet. And so that's how it works in the right-wing daily agenda setting. But then Rushbo got a little confused because he believes that Google is out to get Trump. And then he got a little messed up about whether Google giving answers to how you could change your vote would somehow help Biden, when the suggestion in this whole spun-up story is that people who voted for Biden then heard about the Hunter information now want to change their votes. Now, there is no evidence to suggest this, but there wouldn't be, even if this is the case. So Trump's tweet says, "Strongly trending at Google," which is not true. "Since immediately after the second debate," that's not true. A leading search term is, "Can I change my vote?" And in his tweet, Trump said this refers changing it to me. So it turns out that there are only a couple of states where there is a convoluted process where you can go in and say, "Hey, I voted early. I want my ballot back because I'm going to make a change." But searches for "Can I change my vote to Trump?" and "Can I change my vote to Biden?" have both seen small increases in the past few days. But according to BuzzFeed, which is where I sourced this article, contrary to Trump's claim, only a handful of states have laws that allow voters to make a change, each with different restrictions. And attempting to do so anywhere else can be considered voting twice, which of course is illegal, and Trump has encouraged some of his voters to attempt to vote twice to see if the system's block them from an in-person vote after they submitted a mail-in ballot. Every day I pause to mention a few people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast with your subscriptions. People like Carol Beam, Marvin Rasmussen, whistleblower Joe Carson, and Margaret Anderson. They've all been very generous supporters of this podcast, and I appreciate each and every one of you. And I want to let you know that over the next few days, I'll announce my exit strategy here. I'm planning to retire once we have the election results resolved, and I don't know exactly when that's going to be. So I'll be continuing until further notice, but I do have plans of how I'm going to wind this down, and I will be sharing that with you over the next few days or so. Now, I feel like I'm pretty well wired about Silicon Valley. I mean, I don't know every new startup and every, you know, new wrinkle in the hardware or software worlds. But Sunday's New York Times brought me up to speed on an issue I didn't know about. And that is, there is a secret deal, or it's been kept fairly secret, between Google and Apple. And Google has been paying Apple $8 to $12 billion a year. And it doesn't cost Apple anything. The deal is that the payments, which are a percentage of the advertising profits that Google makes, are paid to Apple in exchange for Apple making sure that on your iPhone and your iPad and your MacBook Pro or your Mac 27, that Google is the preferred search engine. More than half of Google's traffic comes from Apple products. And so even though the introduction of the Android phone kind of poisoned the chemistry between Apple and Google, this is one of the deals that both parties are eager to continue and not to have disrupted by other issues. And it sure seems like a ripe target for an antitrust lawsuit. But, of course, I'm not a lawyer. I wanted to mention that listener Ford Green shared a link with me to a videotape of an online conference that was held in the last few days. And it was gathered together by Bandy Lee, the professor at Yale who's a psychiatrist who edited a book about Trump's unfitness for office. And it's called The Emergency Conference, Donald Trump's Great Harm to America and the World. And I've posted a link to it in the show file for today's podcast. I watched part of it, and I think it's pretty interesting. Now we take a look at some of the issues that have put Facebook in hot water, and there are quite a few of them. I have referenced the effort by Facebook to kill a New York University project that allowed certain people who were part of the project to, like, roll your mouse over a political ad, and it would reveal to you the targeting criteria that were used to deliver that particular ad to you and your particular eyeballs. And I think this is a fascinating study. It's the kind of transparency that Facebook should be offering on a daily basis. I mean, I really would like to know where some of the ads that are served to me came from and what data was collected and where that led somebody to pay a nickel to show me that ad. But that might mess up the secret artificial intelligence algorithms that are used by Facebook to monetize me as their product. So over at Mint Press, a couple of good stories about Facebook today. First, Raul Diego published a piece about how Facebook has vowed to clean up the fake news, the misleading information, the promotion of so-called conspiracy theories by creating their special oversight board. And so Diego exercises a little oversight of his own, and he looks at some of the people who have been picked by Facebook to essentially act as judges and censors. One of them is Emmy Palmore, a former general director of the Israeli Ministry of Justice, where she was directly responsible for the removal of tens of thousands of Palestinian posts from Facebook. And before she got fired from that job, Palmore had created the so-called Internet Referral Unit at the ministry, a cybersecurity team that deliberately targeted and took down the aforementioned content and whose nomination to the Facebook Oversight Board was loudly protested by pro-Palestinian advocacy groups back in May. There's also Michael McConnell, a constitutional law scholar and a right-winger who served 7 years on the U.S. Court of Appeals. He wrote the dissenting opinion in the seminal Ten Commandments case, which centered around the government's authority to decide which monuments can be erected in a public park. And McConnell, who has been floated, I don't believe, any relation to Mitch, and I still don't know what's wrong with Mitch. I saw the latest picture of him, and he kept his right hand in his pants pocket. Anyway, this Judge McConnell has been floated as a potential Supreme Court nominee by the Trump government. So these are some of the fine folks who have been chosen to hear appeals. If you have a Facebook post that is taken down by the company, or more accurately, by its robots, and then you appeal, well, if you're lucky, you'll get your case before this group. And then you'll wonder just how lucky you are. Now, Samantha Power served in the Obama administration, and she is echoing her husband, Cass Sunstein, who several years back argued that conspiracy theories in social media had to be snuffed out, even if it took using covert government operatives to educate the wayward people. So now Power is urging Facebook to do more to crush what she calls conspiracy theories and disinformation that is circulating on its platform. And this occurs after, of course, Zuckerberg has empowered the Atlantic Council to be one of the partners who evaluates the truthiness or falsiness of information that people post on Facebook. And the Atlantic Council is a group that helped sell Russiagate, which I consider to be one of the most virulent conspiracy theories that Facebook and the corporate media have promoted in recent years. And recently, you recall, we heard that the Russians interfered in the French elections in 2017. Well, it's possible that that was an operation that was run by somebody else, maybe, you know, a group that uses the letters C, I, and A. But it's been blamed on Russia. And we'll get to that in a moment as we look at some great articles published today at consortiumnews.com. But Samantha Power probably got this across the breakfast table from her hubby, Cass Sunstein. Back in 2009, he argued that the U.S. government should be conducting cognitive infiltration and persuasion of anti-establishment groups that he calls conspiracy networks, suggesting that government agents and their allies might enter chat rooms, online social networks, or even real space groups and attempt to undermine percolating conspiracy theories. Well, Cass, the FBI is already doing that, mostly with Muslim groups, but apparently more recently with armed right-wing extremist groups here in the U.S. And our last story about Facebook here is from the Washington Post today and its media columnist, Margaret Sullivan. And she builds on what we reported last week, the complaints of Clara Jeffrey, the editor of Mother Jones magazine, that Facebook's shift a couple of years ago to reduce the promotion of certain right-wing websites has actually affected left-of-center media organizations much more. And Sullivan cites a group called the Courier Newsroom. It's funded by dark money, but so are many right-wing outlets. And they started local news sites in Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, Virginia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. And they apparently run a fairly honorable journalism operation. But because of their funding from Democrats or liberals, Facebook has targeted them and throttled back their distribution. And that ends up with the top performing Facebook posts on a daily basis being dominated by Fox News, Breitbart, Franklin Graham, and Ben Shapiro. Kevin Roos at the New York Times, who tracks social media, he said what sticks out when you dig into the data is just how dominant Facebook Right truly is. Pro-Trump political influencers have spent years building a well-oiled machine, creating a torrent of viral commentary that reliably drowns out both the mainstream media and the liberal opposition. And Emily Bell, director of Columbia University's Center for Digital Journalism, says Facebook is a giant presence in the publishing environment, and in some cases, it is in fact the publishing environment. And she's done groundbreaking research on the pink slime sites that present themselves as legitimate local news but are largely right-wing aggregators, some of which charge clients for publishing what masquerades as news coverage. So compare what's going on at Facebook to the Epoch Times. And Epoch is spelled E-P-O-C-H. If you go to YouTube quite a bit, and you don't pay YouTube to avoid ads, Epoch Times has run a lot of what they call pre-roll ads, and it's a guy who comes on and tells you about the great journalism that they do there. And I was sucked in for a while because Epoch Times, in their support of Trump, has been anti-Russiagate. So on Saturday at home, my mailbox featured a free copy of the latest issue of the Epoch Times print edition. And I noticed just right away the bias that they show, because their lead story here is China had COVID-like patients months before official timeline. And in the opening sentence, they refer to COVID-19, and then they give it a second reference as the CCP virus. CCP stands for Chinese Communist Party. And even if you want to blame China and the Wuhan lab as being the source of COVID-19, which may or may not turn out to be true, Trump calls it the China virus, the plague that came from China, the Wuhan flu, and all of those are relatively generic. But to target the Chinese Communist Party and suggest that the Epoch Times already knows that it caused COVID-19 and that it essentially flooded the world with this illness to bring down the American economy, to harden support against Donald Trump, well, that's what you get from the pages of the Epoch Times. So then on Sunday, the New York Times featured a front page story that unveils who's really responsible for the Epoch Times. And it is the promotional arm of Falun Gong. Falun Gong is this banned religious movement from China, and it is led by a man named Li, L-I, and he is known by his disciples as Master. And Li introduced Falun Gong in China in 1992. It revolves around a series of five meditation exercises and a process of moral self-improvement. And in addition to the media empire, Falun Gong also promotes Shen Yun. And if you recall, I mean, here in the Bay Area, Shen Yun was this dance performance group. It was renting out big auditoriums and putting on all these shows, and they spent incredible amounts of money on TV ads. And I had never heard of Shen Yun, and, you know, I mean, it's kind of like river dancing from Asia. That's my uninformed or ignorant perspective on it. At any rate, this reminds me very much of what happened in the 1970s. Richard Nixon ran into trouble, and Reverend Sung Myung Moon of the Korean-based Unification Church, he came to Nixon's rescue. And I can't remember if he bought an existing paper, but he launched the Washington Times. which was a counterpoint to the Washington Post and on a daily basis could be relied upon to produce articles favorable to Richard Nixon. And that's what Epoch Times reminds me of today after having a free copy delivered to me through the U.S. mail. And I wonder what kind of delays they suffered in getting that crap to me. So I have a favorable report about my governor, Gavin Newsom, and I have a highly critical one. We'll start with a favorable one. Gavin Newsom has signed on to a statement filed with the state Supreme Court, which deplores the death penalty having been applied in a racist manner against African Americans. Now, his filing did not call for abolition of the death penalty. He's basically temporarily put it on hold. He's imposed a moratorium, so as long as he's governor, there will be no executions in California. But Newsom argued that a jury imposing a death sentence should be required to find beyond a reasonable doubt that it was the proper punishment, and that jurors should be allowed to consider factors favoring the death penalty, such as other violent acts by the defendant, but only if they agreed unanimously that those events had occurred. And Newsom wrote, "California's capital punishment system is now and always has been infected by racism. Since its inception, the American death penalty has been disproportionately applied first to enslaved Africans and African Americans, and later to free black people. With this filing, we make clear that all Californians deserve the same right to a jury trial that is fair and that is a matter of life and death." Well, I appreciate that, Governor. And I also am looking forward to your response to the Court of Appeals decision written by a man I know and admire named J. Anthony Klein that's ordering you to reduce the population of San Quentin, which is half a mile from where I sit, by 50% until the pandemic is behind us. And I believe that the governor has failed. Well, overall, he's done a decent job responding to the pandemic. When it comes to the prison system, San Quentin in particular, and our nursing home networks, I would give him failing marks. And we have to give Gavin Newsom failing marks as well when it comes to the contradictions of his public statements about climate change, his lecturing of Donald Trump when Trump came here to observe the wildfires back in September. Because Gavin Newsom, while he talks about banning fracking or hydrofracturing by 2024, he keeps issuing permits for fracking oil wells. And I want to thank Steve Horn, the young journalist who covers this beat and has been relentless in exposing this. And he shows how Jason Kenney, who was a senior advisor to Newsom before he became governor and is now a lobbyist who represents companies that sought the fracking permits, mostly in Kern County, that's Bakersfield, in Southern California, that he has those connections to Newsom. And Kenney's wife is the stylist for the woman who's married to Newsom, who prefers to call herself the first partner of California, and that's Jennifer Siebel Newsom, who I know a little bit, and she's a decent person who does some great work in breaking down gender barriers. But this is an unseemly connection between the governor and lobbyists, and he has been delivering to the oil industry one batch of approved permits after another. And Steve Horn details that there were some in April, there were some around Memorial Day, there were some around the 4th of July, and there was another batch. And he points out that the methane emissions, which continue to rise in 2020, are quite prevalent in Kern County, that the local groundwater is so loaded with benzene, ethyl benzene, and xylenes that it is not safe to drink. And so Newsom is pulling a fast one here, or attempting to. He's issued 190% more oil drilling permits in the first half of 2020 compared with the first half of 2019 when he took office. He has issued over 7,000 new permits since taking office in 2019. That is not on track to ban fracking. And in case you need a little fresh evidence about the threat that we face here due to climate change, The Guardian today reports the scientists have found evidence that frozen methane deposits in the Arctic Ocean have started to be released over a large area of the continental slope off the East Siberian coast. High levels of the potent greenhouse gas have been detected down to a depth of 350 meters near the Laptev Sea near Russia. The slope sediments contain a huge quantity of frozen methane and other gases known as hydrates. And these are producing bubble-ups where the gas is coming up through the water and being released into the atmosphere. And this is considered one of the foremost serious scenarios for abrupt climate change. The international team said most of the bubbles were currently dissolving in the water, but methane levels at the surface were 4 to 8 times what would normally be expected. At this moment, there's unlikely to be any major impact on global warming, but the point is that this process has now been triggered. This East Siberian slope methane hydrate system has been perturbed, and the process will be ongoing. That is the Swedish scientist Orjan Gustafsson of Stockholm University. The discovery of activity releasing shelf slope hydrates is very important. It was unknown until now. And I'll just remind you that the permafrost, which is larded with methane, and it's kind of the crust in tundra areas, as I understand it, it too is melting and releasing centuries of built-up methane. Finally, for the second year in a row, this team has found crater-like pockmarks in the shallower parts of the Laptev Sea and the East Siberian Sea that are discharging bubble jets of methane, which is reaching the surface at levels tens to hundreds of times higher than normal. And temperatures in Siberia were 5 centigrade higher than average from January to June of this year, an anomaly that was made at least 600 times more likely by human-caused emissions of carbon dioxide and methane. Last winter's sea ice melted unusually early. This winter's freeze has yet to begin, already a later start than at any time on record. Philadelphia yesterday in the afternoon, cops pumped 10 bullets into Walter Wallace, a 27-year-old black man with mental issues, who the officer said had a knife. And when we try to break down the sequence of events, police were called after a domestic disturbance. Walter Wallace has a history of mental issues, especially when he's off his meds. And this is another case where the police were called to try to de-escalate a situation. And the cops say that Walter Wallace was holding a knife. The cops ordered him to drop it, but instead he advanced toward them. Now, why does it take 10 shots that were ultimately fatal to disarm a man with a knife who is not immediately in your face? And his father, Walter Wallace Sr., asked the Philadelphia Inquirer, why didn't they use a taser? He has mental issues. Why do you have to gun him down? So this led to protests, which did lead to some bad behavior, including some looting, what some people might call rioting. And so it goes, time and again. As I mentioned, Consortium News has a couple of great reports today. One is a reprise of the work of WikiLeaks, and it takes us back to the release of what was called Vault 7, which was CIA information, including their hacking tools. And in this piece written by Patrick Lawrence, he connects the documents and the tools from Vault 7 to the recently floated allegations that it was Russia that interfered in France in the 2017 election that led to the ascendance of Macron, the current prime minister. So I think it's a fascinating read, and I encourage you to check it out. Also at Consortium, an interesting kind of a history primer about Sudan, which exposes that the recent agreement announced by Trump between Sudan and Israel is really just a press release. It's not the peace deal that Trump touted. And the sordid history of U.S. intervention in Sudan surfaces as a central factor in the history of that country. And it was once a very proud and democratic country with multiple political parties. Here's today's COVID-19 update, edited by Linda Lewis. The worldwide death count associated with COVID-19 is now at 1.15 million. 43 million cases reported worldwide. The case count in the United States is upwards of 8.6 million today. 63,589 new cases were listed yesterday. The seven-day moving average for new cases in the U.S. is remaining at 70,000. And there were we now have 225,000 total deaths, and there were 483 new ones reported yesterday. Italy is bracing for another day of protests against virus-fighting steps that have closed restaurants and bars and shut down gyms and pools. Discontent with renewed restrictions aimed at stopping the surge is growing all over Europe. The Trump administration is set to announce as early as this week that Medicare and Medicaid will cover out-of-pocket costs for a potential coronavirus vaccine if it is granted emergency use authorization. And this is obviously a political move that Trump is using to promote his theme that, the end is in sight, we're turning the corner, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, the problems continue with the vaccine makers saying, well, you know, we're not going to make any of those deadlines that Trump was dreaming of. And Eli Lilly has announced it's ending its study into an antibody drug for people hospitalized with COVID-19 because it doesn't seem to be helping them. Independent monitors had paused enrollment in the study 2 weeks ago because of a possible safety issue. But yesterday, the agency, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is sponsoring the study, said a closer look did not verify a safety problem but found a low chance that the drug would prove helpful for hospitalized patients. In a statement, Lilly notes that the government is continuing a separate study testing the antibody drug in mild to moderately ill patients. U.S. health officials are urging Americans to get their flu shots this year in the hopes of thwarting a winter twindemic, a situation in which both the flu and COVID-19 spread and sicken the public. A new study suggests there could be another key reason. It might reduce your risk of COVID-19 if you get a flu shot. This research, released as a preprint that's not yet been peer-reviewed, indicates that a flu vaccine against the influenza virus may also trigger the body to produce broad infection-fighting molecules that will combat the pandemic causing a coronavirus. This paper is in line with some other recent studies that have been peer-reviewed that point to similar effects, but they caution this research is preliminary. Linda notes this is good news potentially, but she predicts this report will become fodder for efforts to convince Americans that COVID-19 is just the flu, which could have negative impacts on other efforts to control the virus. In Arkansas, a state senator tested positive for the virus marking the seventh case among lawmakers in the past week. Senator Cecile Bledsoe, a Republican, tested positive Sunday. Bledsoe co-chairs the Joint Budget Committee and is the mother of the state Surgeon General, Greg Bledsoe. The president of the Senate said lawmakers plan to resume budget hearings this week, but with new safety procedures. On Sunday, Representative Charlene Feit, a Republican, revealed the positive test in a Facebook post. She said she was experiencing mild symptoms and would quarantine. State health officials reported 797 new coronavirus cases Sunday in Arkansas, and total active cases rose to 9,766. 15 new deaths brought the death toll in Arkansas to 1,812. And Stephen Farmer, who served as chairman of the Craighead County Republican Committee, died today after a weeks-long battle with the coronavirus that resulted in treatment with a ventilator and in an ICU. And the news comes just 3 weeks after his committee hosted an event with U.S. Senator Tom Cotton and Congressman Louie Gohmert of Texas, who had contracted COVID back in July. Also, we have an outbreak, and yesterday I got my words backwards. I called it a breakout in the White House. This one is at the parallel universe called Fox News. And in a memo written by President of Fox News Jay Wallace and its CEO Suzanne Scott, they acknowledge that some staffers had tested positive, and it turns out that the super spreader event may have been a chartered plane ride to Nashville for the presidential debate last Thursday night. All four of the big stars who were on board, and that included Brett Baier, Martha McCallum, Dana Perino, and Juan Williams, they have been tested. I don't know the exact results of that, but they now are scaling back their election night plans to include only essential personnel in their studio settings. And an internal memo from Fox News staffers noted that one of their producers, Rob Brown, who had been with the network for over 20 years, had passed away. And he, we think, based on the Daily Beast reporting, that he died from coronavirus complications. So it's everywhere. And we have a slight change in the lineup of the top five states battling coronavirus right now. It is the Dakotas, followed by Wisconsin, Montana, and Guam has been bumped out by Wyoming. And as I close in on the end of today's News and Comment podcast, I want to share a couple of items from the archives. John Zwiebel shared with me a review of Aaron Sorkin's new film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, written by a Reddit poster known as You Welsh Terrier 2. Well, you know who you are, Welsh Terrier. But this individual made some interesting comments about Sorkin's new movie. And he notes, as I did, that Chicago Mayor Richard Daley was not included in the film, and that the contexts of the film, the trial, I thought missed some of that important framing. And the poster writes, Sorkin is a highly skilled writer. The story evoked powerful emotions. Dialogue was superb. The characters well-developed. Acting top-notch. But for those who want a true feel of the 1960s anti-war movement and the Cultural Revolution of the 60s, the movie didn't come close. Worse, Sorkin's efforts to capture the real feel of the Chicago Trial 7 itself fell way short. And he noted that Judge Hoffman is depicted as a competent judge when, in fact, Judge Hoffman was quite a serious bumbler in the courtroom, and he was an unpredictable factor who really had a big impact in the appeals that overturned his convictions. And I got permission to share with you, my listeners, the archives of the courtroom drawings of the Chicago 8, then Chicago 7 case that were produced by my brother's father-in-law. His name was Franklin McMahon. And Mac is gone now, but he was Time and Life magazine's courtroom artist for the Chicago 8 and the Chicago 7 trial, as it devolved into. And I'm putting up a link to a collection of over 400 of his courtroom drawings. And if you roll your mouse over each drawing, you can enlarge it, but you can also get the details on who is depicted in that particular drawing. And what's interesting is that Aaron Sorkin chose to leave out a lot of the famous people who testified on behalf of the defendants, like Phil Oakes, Allen Ginsberg, Bobby Seale, well, Seale's in there, Dick Gregory, Timothy Leary, Arlo Guthrie, Judy Collins, Norman Mailer, and Jesse Jackson. So you'll find all of these people plus Judge Julius Hoffman in many depictions by a man whose work I found to be quite impressive, Franklin McMahon. And finally today, I'm going to leave you with an audio clip from archives of WCFL Radio. And I have to tell you this story because it's personal. One of my idols as a radio DJ and personality was a man named Ron Britton. And Ron, who was also known as King B, he died this past Sunday. And he decided to end his life because his wife of 62 years, who was known as Peach, she had died just a week before. And he could not face going to her funeral. And so Ron Britton decided to check out, and I respect the choice that he made. Ron made an outsized impression on your humble host when I was a kid. He was a top DJ at our top 40 rock and roll station in Cincinnati, WSAI. And I loved his act. He used a lot of sound effects, a lot of character voices. And he was manic in the Robin Williams zone, if you will. Then I was really disappointed when he left WSAI, but a couple of years later he showed up in Chicago on a powerhouse 50,000-watt AM station, WCFL, owned by the Chicago Federation of Labor. And their directional signal beamed right into that transistor radio that my parents used to routinely take away from me when I'd fall asleep each night listening to Ron Britton all the way from Chicago. And through no fault of my own, I ended up working at the same radio station as Ron Britton in the 1970s. I did the all-night talk show on WDAI-FM, and Ron came in to relieve me at 5 a.m. And that's how I got to know my radio idol. And what was remarkable is that Ron had scratched out a few notes, and he'd huddle with his engineer because we were not, by union rules, allowed to operate the equipment. And so he'd tell Lou Sabatini, hey, you know, I need Rex with the Wurlitzer, and then I'd like a lady to shout at me, and then I need a door slam and the gong. And Lou would load those into the tape players. They're called carts, cart machines. And he would just basically freelance alongside Ron Britton's performance. And what you're about to hear is an air check of Ron Britton from 1969 on WCFL, where likewise he was working with a very talented board operator who could read Ron's intentions. You'll hear this zany collection of Britton's comments, the way he plays along with the music, knows all the lyrics, and the insertion of trick voices and sound effects and other elements that made for an incredible radio experience. Ron Britton, happy trails to you.
Merry Christmas from Biggie Tim.
Big Ten, WCFL.
Gladys Knight and the Pepperonis and all aboard!
Sure, baby.
Well, that's right. I think they're calling our train right now.
Track 4. All aboard?
I think they're calling my train a long time ago.
Everybody, friends, radio program. 11 minutes past the hour of 10 bells from Biggie 10 WCFNL and Rise and Webbo-wise with Quawk Webbo on Big 10 Radio, 6 to 10 a.m. every morning. Matter of fact, Quawk is in his little office preparing his radio program for tomorrow. And here's Quawk with a few words about tomorrow's program.
Fantastic.
We all got our fingers crossed, Clark.
Make your man a legend in his own time. For those special occasions, give him the special gift. Give him British Sterling aftershave and cologne, and you may both go down in history.
Of course, ladies and gentlemen, it's available in the cosmetic department.
Oh, no!
Well, I mean, what's wrong with that of all Sears stores?
WCFL. Here tonight.
Ron Britton. Ron
Britton. Oh! Stevie, Stevie Wonder.
Yes, sir, you. Yes, sir, they. Yes, sir, that's my BB.
What happened to?
The giant hunt is over. Five Tonic Marina City, 29 degrees. Mike Drexler, WCFL News.
Ron Britton!
Right now, Jimmy T's bag is tending bar for those 21 and over at the Chicago Bears Dug for Fine's Nickel Bag at 4740 North River Road in Schiller Park. He's going to get nothing but trouble out there. Wednesday night, Dick Biondi and the Funky Down Home Band appear at the all-new Nightfall Lounge, 5551 North Broadway. Robert E. Lee tends bar for those 21 and over. Wednesday at... Now, what's a nice boy like that doing tending bar? At Mother's 26 West Division with Nightly. He's going to get nothing but trouble there, too, with Nightly Entertainment till 2:30 in the a.m. way out morning. Ron Brittoni MC's Lane Tech Night with the all-girl band, The Circle of Love. Wednesday at Anton's on Lincoln Avenue at Addison Night. And I mean to tell you, there's nothing but trouble there, too. No, we have a ball there, too. And I'll be joining the Summer Winds Friday at the old glass Gaslight Pub at 7151 Foster in Harlem for those 21 and up. And Ron Britton appears at Justine's, 5107 Oakton in Skokie. Oh, that's going to be beautiful. Saturday at 2. We'll see you out there, y'all.
Slipping away.
Yes.
Sitting on a pillow.
Shall we toast a few?
Waiting for night.
I mean, like, celebrate.
Ha! Girl in a dream, sitting on a pillow. This is the night. Going to celebrate.
That's a three dog night.
Saddling late. There's a little kid. Didn't find time to call.
WCFL. Big Camp.
Just you, of course, I love you so very much. A baby Britton kiss, and I love you, I love you, I love you. Mm. Number uno, 111, Diana Ross, Monty Supremes in Someday, Someday.
Audience, welcome back to the Ron Britton Radio Program. How do you like the show so far? That's what I thought. That was what I was afraid of, basically. Well, if you'll turn to page
17 of the program. You'll see the time for one of the good old Ron Britton stations. King B. Ron Britton, America's first psychedelic disc jockey. Willa Willa, the reason to walk, he can broadcast in stereo. This is it, folks. Protest that paper who wouldn't print my grill stool pigeon on a ground glass. The musical time tone exactly. Look at that. Tom Jen, 30.
What a great act.
I'm not acting. Baby. R.B. Greaves. Get off my lap, Maria. Take a letter.
Take a letter, Maria. Oh, I
guess it's
my wife.
Keep me rolling, Britain, ladies and gentlemen, the musical time tone. Music and more time. 27 minutes away from the hour of 11 o'clock, and that from Big Ten Radio, WCFNL. Do you want me to spell that? WCFNL.
An artist is a dreamer.
A welcome gift for someone on your baby Christmas list.
Live.
Big Ten WCFNL.
Did he say live? Chance of snow flurries near the lake tonight.
Here tonight.
No, wait a minute, Cleo. Tonight's low around 13 freezing degrees in that baby. Partly cloudy tomorrow with a high of just freezing 32. Low?
28.
No, low in the low 20s for tomorrow night. Right now, downtown Marina.
It's tomorrow?
Yeah.
High,
it's 50. No, I told you, it's freezing. 32 will be the high.
None.
20 what?
You're out of your
for
head.
Letting you appear on the show. 29 degrees downtown Marina. The southwest is currently 27. The northwest, 24.
Fair tonight.
No time for that, Leo. Bank of the rocket ship. Ah, Jack Armstrong. Fancy meeting your fancy.